Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Cross Wires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan, and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts, and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times Radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times Radio app. We bring you politics without the boring bits every day on the podcast. There's definitely no boring bits in politics right now, from David Cameron's cabinet comeback to Suella Braverman's stroppy non-resignation letter. And then the news that the government's Rwanda plan has been blocked by the Supreme Court.
The changes needed to eliminate the risk of reformant may be delivered in the future, but they have not been shown to be in place now. The Home Secretary's appeal is therefore dismissed.
So plenty for us to discuss on the podcast today. Coming up, it's PMQ's Unpacked. Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer going at it. Plenty for them to go at, with trouble on both sides, whether it's Rishi Sunak and all of his problems this week, or Keir Starmer's and this vote that's coming up on whether or not Labour will support a ceasefire in the Middle East. So PMQ's Unpacked is coming up in just a moment. But first, as we always do on a Wednesday, it's these two.
The Columnists with Ali Burt, Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton on Times Radio.
And here they are. Hello, Alice.
Morning.
Sad. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Matt.
So we should, let's start with the ruling from, in the broadest sense, it's sort of good day, bad day for Rishi Sunak when it comes to his five pledges.
Yeah.
Here are his pledges.
We will halve inflation, grow the economy, reduce debt, cut waiting lists and stop the boats.
So, good day so far. He's halved inflation. Has he? Inflation has halved. Can he claim the credit for that, Alice?
Well, it depends. I think if you're going to take the credit for it being halved, you've also got to take the credit if it goes up, or rather the agony when it goes up. So you're either all in or all out. You can't sort of pretend that as soon as you've halved it, it's your decision and anything else has nothing to do with
you. When it went up, it was Ukraine.
Yeah, it was all everyone else's problem, wasn't it?
Global forces and Liz Truss and whatever.
And it's come down partly because of the bank setting the interest rates.
Which is independent.
Yeah.
There's nothing to do with it. So we're sort of chalking that up as, you know...
But the fact is... Politically, it's a big win, isn't it? And it's probably a bigger win than the Rwanda thing is a loss, to be honest.
Will notice it in the end.
Yeah, in terms of the impact on people's lives.
There was a point in the summer where halving, because we bought about just over 10% at the beginning of the year.
Yeah, it got to 11%.
In the summer, it looked a bit dicey. It wasn't going to happen.
Yeah.
It's now at 4.6%. As long as there's not a pre-Christmas spike, it'll be there at the end of the year.
Yeah.
You can short that up as a win.
Yeah, Jeremy Hunt, big grin on his face on the telly this morning.
Which is nice, because he often looks like he's about to burst into
tears. He does, yeah.
And he's got the budget as well, so they're in a good place for that.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Then, let's turn our attention to stopping the boats. Mm. Clearly, a big part of trying to deter people to cross the channel
was the threat that if you arrived here illegally, you'd be put on a plane and thrown to Rwanda. It's been to every court so far. It's reached the Supreme Court. Here is the judge, Lord Reed, setting out why the Rwanda plan is still not lawful.
Asking ourselves whether there were substantial grounds for believing that a real risk of reformant existed at the relevant time, we have concluded that there were. The changes needed to eliminate the risk of reformant may be delivered in the future, but they have not been shown to be in place now. The Home Secretary's appeal is therefore dismissed.
Reformant, it's one of those words that we're all just learning
suddenly
existed.
We're going to get very, furlough was one. A word. So this is the...
Words we didn't know existed.
Didn't know existed. So this is the concern that someone could be sent to Rwanda and then Rwanda could send them back to an unsafe country that we wouldn't do. So for instance, if someone claims asylum in the UK and they're from Afghanistan, the UK judges that Afghanistan is not a safe place to send someone back to. What you don't want is then to be sent to Rwanda, and then Rwanda sends them back to Afghanistan. And so it's putting in place...
Rwanda was put there as a threat, as you say, as a deterrent, and it's proved to be too much of one, really, hasn't it? Because it's not somewhere that it's too much of a threat for the judges to accept. They had this example of Israelis sending asylum seekers back there some of them had been secretly shipped to Uganda, I think, and then possibly run the risk of being sent home. So obviously there's bribery or people trafficking or something dodgy going on in Rwanda, which they couldn't accept. So they chose the wrong country, essentially.
But
it would have only been 300-odd people on a plane anyway.
You needed a country, Alice, that was bad enough, in inverted commas. Yep. You know, you were sort of... when the Home Office go through their list of...
You can't have Germany, can you?
Exactly. So Germany's at the top, so you're sort of more at the bottom of the list.
But it's too bad.
But it's right.
Can we just say that having been to Rwanda a few times and having covered the genocide there, it actually is a very beautiful country, and it is in many ways. The people are incredibly kind, and you have to say that. I think we can't be that rude about Rwanda the whole time from here, as if like, oh my God, that's a terrorist. And I think that's part of it. It's just unbelievably rude as well to say.
But it's not rude of the judge to say that their system was not sufficiently...
Well, they're not into being rude or not. They're just looking at what's going to happen.
Exactly. I mean,
But this again goes to the heart of the tension in the government's plan. They're trying to simultaneously say, Rwanda, terrible country, if you go there, you know, that'll be a deterrent. Yeah. And then Sweta Braverman, when she was Home Secretary, went there and was joking, oh, it's lovely here, isn't it? Oh, I love what you've done in here, because she went and saw some of the places where they might be sent to live, and just joking about wanting the interior designer's phone number.
Yeah.
So, but you can't have it both ways, because if it's that nice, it's no longer a deterrent. It's like, if all else, the worst thing that can happen is you end up in lovely Rwanda.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? But also the problem is it's 350 people. I mean, it's a tiny amount of people. And this is, we're now in the sort of hundreds of thousands. So I think it's really complicated what they do. It is just a deterrent, and that's why it's so difficult.
Yeah, it was purely symbolic, wasn't it, in terms of the numbers, just like the barge is symbolic and various other measures that they've come up with.
So what do you... I mean, this feels like this is, this is not the end. I suspect that we'll hear from PMQs a bit later.
Yeah.
And
the fact that it is symbolic in a way helps the government, because they can say, well, we tried, but these nasty human rights lawyers have
I wonder whether they might be more emollients. Actually, now with James Cleverly at the... Yeah, he's clearly trying a very different approach at the Home Office. He went in and made a speech to all the staff and told him he was just going to knuckle down and get on with the quiet boy business. If they just say, we're going to take it on board, the court has set out the issues we need to address, and we're going to get on and do that while we're also doing some other things, they'd actually try to take the heat out of some of this a bit and looking...
The only problem about that is you've got Suella Braverman. She's going to be using this, isn't she? So that's the difficult point for them. And I think James Cleverly could try and calm it all down, but she will use every opportunity she can to say, look, what are you doing? You've done nothing. You're not being strong enough. You've been too weak. And I think that's going to be very difficult because it will be a dividing line now in the Tory party.
But as Danny Finkelstein wrote this morning, it looks like Sunak has made his choice and he's intending to marginalise those people. And so you might as well just get on with it and start behaving like a grown-up government again, finally. Yeah. After you've got Cameron back, you've got the sensible guy at the Home Office, you've got people... We're going to talk about health in a minute, and Therese Coffey's gone. So it looks to everybody like, as a sensible government of the the grown-up Tory centre-right. So, yeah, wouldn't that be welcome? Would that be welcome if they said, well, yeah, thank you, Lord Justice Reid, yeah, or whatever, and we'll do our...
We'll revisit our homework. And actually, the follow-on from that is just to ignore some of the parliament, which so far there's been no exchange of letters.
But also, her letter is just extraordinary because it's so personal. So it's all about, you lied to me. There's nothing to do about whether we lied to the country or what they're going to do or what she's done to help. Or, you know, it's all about her and her personal, you know, career and whether or not she can get to the top and whether or not, how she can improve herself. And it just seems so utterly selfish and so much a continuation of this psychodrama that everyone else has had absolutely enough of that I think they probably can ignore her now.
Yeah, I think it was in Lara Spirit said this morning that some Tory backbencher said narcissistic crap. And it does have a real whiff of
fundamentally, and I've got to keep going on about this, but it's not a resignation letter. She was sacked. If she'd have laid out all of this a week ago and said, look, I've had enough, we had a deal, it's not working, you've reneged on it all, I'm quitting, then fine. She didn't do that.
Well, she says in the first sentence, I think it's for the best. Well, if it was for the best...
Then you should have... she clung on and on, was disloyal, stirred up things rather than calming them down to no great obvious effect, and then got sacked.
Yeah, and she's petulant.
Exactly. So I'm angry I've been sacked letter.
My main problem with the letter was then you thought, how many of these deals did Rishi Sunak do? That was my only issue. I thought, is this why we had such a bad cabinet for so long under him? Is that he'd done all these different deals with different people and that actually he was just so desperate to get in and become Prime Minister. I think that's the only damaging part for him, is he shouldn't have been doing deals really to get
there. And it's interesting because, it's all with the benefit of hindsight, because it was all very dramatic at that moment when Liz Truss resigned in that weekend and Boris Johnson was coming back from somewhere exotic on holiday. And there was this feeling he needed this sort of critical mass of support and getting...
Well, he needed not to go to the Tory members
to make sure that Boris Johnson didn't run. And getting her on board was a sort of defining moment.
Well, apparently so, and that's the way she's writing. She's writing up, she was the kingmaker.
Yeah.
And that's how she's talking. I mean, who knows whether that's true or not? I mean, I don't know about the deals. I mean, it's just politics, isn't it? People do deals all the time.
It's fundamentally a misunderstanding of politics.
Yes, and if you trust the person you've made the deal with, like, Granita or now and this, then that more fool you, I would think.
Well, because ultimately, it's a misunderstanding of politics. Whatever he promises in order to become Prime Minister, once he's Prime Minister...
It doesn't matter.
Yes.
He can do what he likes.
Well, yeah, and also you are also faced with certain realities when you become Prime Minister that you might change your mind, because you might be persuaded that...
Stuff happens, doesn't it?
Happens, and you're persuaded that you thought could be done can't be done.
That's why I think Suella's... I mean, I think in the end, the Tory party will either have to completely ignore her, or there will be this revolt, because I think we can't tell how serious she is, but I think a lot of the backbenchers now are getting bored of it. I mean, the rest of the country got bored of this so long ago, and it is so myopic and so self-obsessed in the Tory party, and with these individuals who think... I mean, Nadine Dorris is the same. They think it's all about them, and actually, in the end, it's not. It's actually about the country.
And also, when you're staring down the barrel of a general election campaign next year, you'll try to weigh up, does it make sense for us to spend the entire time campaigning against ourselves and pointing out what hasn't worked, and actually maybe focusing on the bits which have?
Well, I think Suella thinks they've already lost, therefore she's sort of positioning herself for the next...
Well, I guess any sensible person, they all think they've already lost. It's a question of how you mitigate that. And the people like Suella say, let's go down in flames, let's do a kind of Götterdämmerung, and other more sensible Tories say, well, let's try and shore up the places that normally vote Tory, because the blue wall is in serious danger.
That's
in
trouble as well.
And a lot of those backbenchers want to keep their seats. I mean, that's also totally self-obsessed, isn't it?
Well, in part, it goes back to the environment, which you've written about in your column today, Alice, and the fact that Therese Coffey... I hadn't realised. I sort of was aware of it, but you sort of brilliantly pulled together all of the groups that she managed to upset.
Yeah, that was great.
As basically Tory minister for the countryside.
Pig Monthly or something.
Yeah, it was all of them.
Special
agricultural publications were set up just to call for her to resign, it turned out. But she's been replaced by Steve Barclay, former health secretary. We learn that his wife works for Anglian Water and is responsible for infrastructure, which, given about the only thing that anyone wants the environment secretary to do is stop all the you-know-what ending up in rivers... And then Victoria Atkins, who's replaced him as health secretary, her husband is chief executive of the world's biggest sugar company, one of the world's biggest sugar companies, British Sugar. Do you think it matters, spouses?
I think it really does matter because I think it just looks almost corrupt, actually. And what's happened is they haven't noticed when Rishi Sunak was doing the reshuffle, he didn't actually look at these people. He's so desperate to find among 350 MPs people who can actually do the job. He's had to go outside to David Cameron. Mm. So he's swapping them all around. But I think actually in the end, they should have said, I think Steve Barclay should have said, this is a conflict of interest. And either his wife has to give up or he shouldn't have taken the position because they are in direct conflict. And I think sewage is a massive deal for quite a lot of people in this country now.
It's already been an issue for Victoria Atkins in a previous job. She had to recuse herself from talking about drugs policy, I think, because not only does the husband run ABF or ABF Sugar, he also, part of his portfolio is the biggest cannabis farm in the legal cannabis farm in the country, which supplies children's epilepsy, medication. So there's already a problem with that. I agree with Alice. I think in the past you might have said, well, you know, everyone's a good chap or a good woman, you know, Chinese walls and all the rest of it. But we've had enough of that, really. I don't think you can have that, particularly the environment one.
I think actually it speaks probably to a flaw in the government processes.
Yeah.
They just, you know, they were so excited about David Cameron, they just don't think it matters.
But then actually, on the other hand, you go into number 10, you know, Rishi Sunak may not know, but, you know, Steve Barclay knew what his wife did. He should have said, I think this is going to be a conflict of interest. And they could have talked it out then. And maybe, he wanted to stay at health anyway. Maybe he should have stayed or been moved somewhere
else. Well, maybe he did.
And it's very specific because any regulation on the regulation that we all know and needs to happen will affect the profits of Anglian Water.
Yeah.
It just will. I mean, it has to. It should do. So, you know, isn't that a kind of, that's a sort of end game. That's the sort of game changer, isn't it? I would have thought.
Well, and it also, it's just the sort of thing which will live for such a long time online in the run-up to an election. The people who are cross about, you know, the salience of these issues.
Yes.
Particularly water.
Yeah.
You know, his wife works for a major...
Yes, and you don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but then... it'd be hard to argue with a conspiracy theorist who said that, and you go, you're right.
So just more headaches for Rishi Sunak.
Yeah.
We've just heard from Rishi Sunak. He's put out a statement in response to the ruling on the Rwanda scheme. He says, we have seen today's judgment and will now consider next steps. This was not the outcome we wanted, but we have spent the last few months planning for all eventualities and we remain completely committed to stopping the boats. Crucially, the Supreme Court, like the Court of Appeal and the High Court before it, has confirmed that the principle of sending illegal migrants to a safe third country for processing is lawful. This confirms the government's clear view from the outset. Legal migration destroys lives and costs British taxpayers millions of pounds a year. We need to end it and we'll do whatever it takes to do so, because when people know that if they come here illegally, they won't get to stay, then they will stop coming altogether and we will stop the boats. So I think we'll probably chalk that up as more at the emollient end of the...
I think that's new Rishi Sunak, don't you?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We take it on board. It's not what we wanted, but we're planning for all eventualities and we're going to keep on.
Yeah, because it wasn't sort of all lefty human rights lawyers, metropolitan media, bubbly doodah, was it? Which is what we normally hear.
I think that's what we provide, metropolitan media, bubbly doodah, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, we've previously had Elton John, picnics, hot weather, strawberry jam. What do you think is overrated now?
Well, this is the Northern Lights. This is actually a week ago when the Northern Lights were visible to more of the country than they normally are.
Yeah.
And I said the Northern Lights look amazing, really, because they look spectacular when you see them on the telly or in still photographs in the newspaper. When you actually see them in the flesh, as it were, which I've done a couple of times in Finland and Norway, they're rubbish. They're really, really disappointing. They're a sort of indistinct green and blue smudge on the horizon.
Yeah, but what you're saying is you've actually been there. I mean, the rest of us haven't been there, so we can't even know.
The weird thing is,
I was going to say, I'm genuinely so uninterested in going to see because of exactly this point you're making.
There you go. I'm on work team is Frampton, done.
But aren't there some reindeer or something you can see, or snow?
The getting to see them is good because you go on a snowmobile, at least in Finland, you go on a snowmobile across the frozen lake, and that is amazingly exciting. But when it's always the journey is better than it's better to just travel than to arrive.
But not prophetic. It will take 1,000 words. In fact, we can speak to someone now who is Matt Robinson. He's a photographer and astronomer working for the Aurora Zone, a Northern Lights holiday company. Hello, Matt.
Oh, no. Hello, how are you?
I'm very good. I'm very good. Is Robert right? They're better in photos than they are in person.
Robert is extremely hard to please, isn't he? I would hate to live with him.
It's only, a couple of things. Elton John picnic.
Really, I mean,
Nicola's going to have that on loop
as well. I'm partial to the odd picnic under the Northern Lights, which I have done.
Oh, there we are. Imagine that picnic under the Northern Lights.
Reindeer sandwich.
I think the thing about the Northern Lights is a reindeer sandwich. I can't comment on that. I think the thing about the Northern Lights is it's a purely natural spectacle that comes from the sun. There's got to be so many things that line up for you to be able to see this. And I think, in a way, he is right. When you see it from the UK, it doesn't tend to be as spectacular as you see on Blue Planet or anybody's images, because you need a strong solar storm to see it in the UK. So what we're seeing in the UK last week and the week before, that is a once-in-a-five-year storm, 10-year storm. But if you were in Finland for that, or Norway, or anywhere in Scandinavia, or in the Aurora zone, good link, you would see something that would absolutely blow your mind.
And now, Matt, if I came on one of your tours and I didn't see them, do I get my money back? Or do you just tell me what a lovely
picnic
we've had?
You know what, on certain tours, what I would say is I'm a Sunderland fan, right? So do you think if I go to the Stadium of Light and they get beat, do you think I ask for my money back? I go to watch it, but there's no guarantee that my team are going to win.
Well, it's a good answer, Matt. I mean, I'm still not coming, but it was a good answer.
Sounds like you were soliciting for a free holiday.
It's the whole experience.
It's a whole experience, exactly.
The snowmobile. And then I'm going there on Saturday, actually, and if you do get the lights, It's the cherry on top. And if you get an amazing storm, then you'll never forget it. Yeah. And you know, one day, Robert, he might actually be happy.
It could be the story jam on top, couldn't it?
Alice Thompson and Robert Crampton there, and you can read them both in the Times every week. Just get yourself a subscription. Go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox. Up next, it's PMQ's Unpacked.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
PMQs Unpacked on Times Radio. Unpacking the politics and cutting through the crossfire.
Order, order. I call Matt Chorley and Tim Shipman.
Yeah, here we are again. And after a couple of weeks off for various reasons, although Tim Shipman very kindly turned up for PMQs last week, didn't you, Tim?
Thank you very much.
You came in, sat down, ready to go, and then...
The fierce urgency of now coursing through my veins, only to be told, not now.
There's no PMQs.
Next week.
Well, anyway, you're here.
I am
very kindly. You, unlike Solibar, when you pitched up a tent and you stayed here for a whole week...
That would be it.
...to make sure you were here. There's only really one thing that's going to come up, isn't there?
Well, I would think, I mean, this is a slightly tricky balancing act for Keir Starmer, isn't it? Because he's going to have to tear the what's it out of the government's immigration policy as a result of the Randall ruling. But we've also got this reshuffle, which, let's be frank, gives some opportunity for comedic value. I've got slightly high hopes. I hope they're not dashed. That the Labour Party gagmeisters might have come up with something this week.
If you can't fashion something out of David Cameron's comeback, then frankly you've no business.
Well, there's that. There's Nigel Farage in the jungle. There's Sibella Braverman.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bit like an episode of Spitting Image about to unfold before our eyes, I suspect.
Never mind. And in quite a week, these might be bigger stories. The Environment Secretary's wife works for a water company. The Health Secretary's husband runs the biggest sugar company in the country. Plenty to go at.
And then Rishi Sunak, how many times is he going to mention inflation in his six answers? Are we going to get six goes at that, or just a couple?
In fact, to try and get ahead of all of that, Rishi said normally the Speaker calls the first question and the Prime Minister just says, I've had various meetings today, I shall have further such meetings later today. Occasionally, the Prime Minister likes to basically issue a little statement at the top. So, in fact, we could bring you that now. This is Rishi Sunak answering a question before one's even been asked.
Thank you. Mr. Speaker, at the start of this year, I made halving inflation my number one priority. Today, we have delivered on that commitment. There remains more to do, but this is a strong step forward. This morning, also, the Supreme Court gave a judgment on the Rwanda plan. They confirmed that the principle of removing asylum seekers to a safe third country is lawful. There are further elements that they want additional certainty on, and noted that changes can be delivered in the future to address those issues. The government has been working already on a new treaty with Rwanda, and we will finalise that in light of today's judgment. And furthermore, if necessary, I am prepared to revisit our domestic legal frameworks. Let me assure the House, my commitment to stopping the boats is unwavering. My right honourable friend, the Home Secretary, will be making an oral statement shortly to the House. Mr. Speaker, this morning I had meetings with ministerial colleagues and others. In addition to my duties in this House, I shall have further such meetings later today.
Yeah. Well, there we are. You got inflation in before anything else. And why wouldn't you? You know, if you had these five targets, everyone said they were stupid and you'd never meet them. He's met one of them, albeit.
Well, it's quite a day for the five targets, isn't it? Because inflation met boats struggling.
Yeah. Boats not quite stopped. In terms of the Rwanda question, he's willing to revisit our domestic legal framework. What does that mean in English?
Well, I mean, they can pass laws that make it clearer that, you know, how you interpret some of the legislation and thoughts of the European Convention, as I understand it. The detail is sort of mind-numbing, but what people like Suella Braverman have been pushing for is kind of these notwithstanding clauses. I don't think he has to necessarily go down that route. He can find different ways of saying the court should interpret these conventions. She's kind of saying ignore it completely. But, you know, it's an extra round of things and it's something that would take a lot of time, and it doesn't then mean that there's going to be time for this to start having much of an effect before a general election. And that's what Suella Braverman's beef was in her resignation letter.
It wasn't a resignation letter?
Apologies. It was a post-sacking justificatory letter.
Very good.
Yeah, she basically sort of said, look, I told you all this months ago and we needed to get it in place and you weren't interested and now you're going to have to do it. It'd be interesting to see which of the specific paths he goes down. And I'm apologising to the listeners if my answer was not quite specific enough. but it is devilishly complicated. You can tell the courts to interpret things differently or you can tell them to ignore things. It seems to me more likely that he's going to tell them to interpret things differently. But, you know, we are in an interesting sort of political context here across the whole of Europe. You've got Europe talking about, you know, offshore processing of migrants and the fact, you know, there's a good chance that Greece and Italy would consider leaving the European Convention as well, given that they're the ones being completely inundated with...
Because there's a people. Problem right across Europe.
Yeah, there's a problem right across Europe. And, you know, there is a case here for some kind of, you know, understanding on how these things are dealt with on a wider basis than just what we get up to in Britain. But that isn't going to satisfy the Tory right conceptually or in the short term. And, you know, I think we're all waiting for Desmond Swain to get to his feet.
Well, exactly. We'll come to that. Let's not wish our lives away, Tim. We'll come to that in a minute. So there we are. Maybe we'll find out what revisiting our domestic legal framework means as Keir Starmer gets to his feet.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The Prime Minister obviously thinks so little of his own MPs that he's had to peel David Cameron away from his 7-year exile in a shepherd's hut and make him Foreign Secretary. But a few months ago, the Intelligence and Security Committee said that the now Foreign Secretary's role in a Chinese investment fund may have been, and this is their words, engineered by the Chinese state. I hardly need to remind the Prime Minister of the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party or the intimidation against members of this House. So when will he instruct the Foreign Secretary to give full public disclosure of his work for Chinese interests?
Mr. Speaker, as I said, I'm delighted that the former Prime Minister has rejoined government as Foreign Secretary. As an individual with unrivalled experience, he will help Britain navigate an uncertain world in challenging times. Of course, like every other government minister, he will go through the normal process with the independent adviser. But the government's position on China is clear. China represents an epoch-defining challenge. That's why we have taken strong and robust steps to protect ourselves against the risk that it poses. But we'll take no lessons, Mr. Speaker, from the Labour Party on protecting our national security. They've taken almost £700,000 from an alleged Chinese agent.
Wow. This could turn into a bit of a rocks throwing in a greenhouse enterprise, couldn't it? So Barry Gardner, formerly of the Shadow Cabinet, took some money from someone who was suspected to be a Chinese spy. One waits for the retort from the leader of the opposition, who points out that the current security minister worked for a sort of counter-Chinese agency in Westminster, which also appears to have employed a Chinese spy who is currently under suspicion and has been helping the police with their inquiries. So this is an interesting area where both sides have problems.
For legal reasons, we should point out that Barry Gardner did not employ the alleged Chinese spy, and he said that, but he did take money. He only found out she was a spy, engaged in illegal activity when approached by security officials.
There we go.
Very good. So let's zoom back then. Interesting decision by Keir Starmer not to talk about inflation, which is fine because, you know, it's a good news day for the Prime Minister, but not to go in on Rwanda, the big story of the day.
Yeah.
And instead, maybe because, you know, it would essentially mean prepping two different sets of questions because you didn't know what was going to happen this morning. And they're actually going for the jugular on David Cameron. David Cameron's clearly got questions about his involvement with China. Yep. He was a very enthusiastic embracer of China when he was Prime Minister, and that seems to have continued since he left office.
That's right. And he's had links with sort of a company that's been doing business, I think, in Sri Lanka with Chinese backing. So, look, it's clear that he was appointed before the usual kind of procedures were completed. I suspect if he's got business interests, he'll be asked to divest himself of them, that will become clear in due course. But yeah, the thing from Starmer's point of view is this is not just hearsay. This is something that the Intelligence and Security Committee has already drawn attention to, you know, is a concern of the kind of securocrats in Whitehall. And this, of course, will have a dynamic inside the Conservative Party as well. Because a lot of those right-wingers who were upset about what's going on with Rwanda and with the sacking of Suella Braverman are also people who are China hawks and don't like this. So David Cameron coming back offends them from a point of view of often being Brexiteers. It offends them because he's more pro-Chinese than they'd like the government to be. And it offends them because it's helped lead to the departure of one of their own. So it's... you know, there's quite a lot going on that's antagonising that wing of the Conservative Party this week.
And it's just a sign of how far we've come in British politics that I was just looking at this, October 2015, so David Cameron, as Prime Minister, talked about a golden era in British-Chinese relationships.
Well, and I mean, it was for about 6 weeks,
and
then
you've got the now Prime Minister, his now boss, calling China an epoch-defining challenge.
That's right.
But
I think there's been a lot of waking up in the West to... Look, China and Russia are slightly different. Russia is an overt security threat. China is in some ways, but it was perceived for a long time to be primarily a commercial threat, that it was about them stealing our intellectual property, nicking our ideas and making them cheaper and quicker and in greater numbers. It's now become clear that China, which for a very long time had quite an insular kind of approach to the world, it was more concerned with people not interfering with their internal affairs and didn't particularly project its power elsewhere, has spent probably the better part of two decades projecting power around the world and having a lot of influence in developing countries. And I think it's taken quite a while for the sort of security and foreign policy establishments of Western countries to kind of wake up to that. Don't forget, they've been obsessed with sort of Islamist terrorism since 9/11. They've been obsessed with collapsing economic problems, you know, from 2008 and again more recently. We've had COVID, we've had, you know, China being a sort of existential kind of foreign policy challenge, I think without all of that would have been much more on the radar for the last 10 or 15 years. But it's becoming much clearer now in the battle for resources and the battle for growth and all the rest of it that there are, you know, something you have to reckon with.
Here we are. Somebody's just been in touch. To not jump on the Rwanda judgment was an astonishing lost opportunity for Starmer. Shows a disturbing lack of agility. Stunned of Clerkenwell. Well, let's see.
It is surprising, but it would only be surprising if we get through six questions without it. I mean, the other thing to consider, of course, is that there is a statement from the Home Secretary, and the story is kind of already there. Whatever Keir Starmer says about it, Keir Starmer's going to be the last two paragraphs after the judges have said it's a disaster.
Yeah, so that might as well be about
Cooper. And the Tory right have said, you know, it's... up with this we will not put. If, you know, this is effectively, from a news management point of view, weaponising a second story that's bad news for the government.
He's got a separate story in the
paper. I can see why he might want to do that.
Right, here we go then. Take 15 minutes to do one question. Let's go back to the House of Commons. This is question two from Keir Starmer.
Keir Starmer!
Mr Speaker, for...
Sorry?
Lindsay,
I think, no, you're on the front bench. We need to just calm down. Keir Starmer.
Is that Richard Holden?
Mr Speaker, for someone who spent the last few weeks complaining about recycling bins, it's ironic that his latest reset involves recycling the architects of 13 years of Tory failure. But this is the Prime Minister who also reanimated the career of the member for Fareham in order to resuscitate his own,
days
after she was sacked for a national security breach.
When he brought it back as
Is he ashamed that he was so desperate to become Tory leader, so scared to face a vote, that he put someone so totally unfit for office in charge of Britain's national security?
Mr Speaker, he mentions 13 years. We remember what happened at the beginning of that 13 years. It was this party that restored this country's financial security Party left no money behind, Mr Speaker, and it is a bit rich to take lectures on security from a man who wanted to make the former member for Islington North Prime Minister of our country.
Jeremy Corbyn.
I mean, that was the easiest comeback in the history of the world, wasn't it?
Although
you know, I mean, literally the language that Starmer was using, you know, totally unfit for office and fears about, you know, security. I mean, literally, that is what the security services would have told you about Jeremy
Corbyn.
He is
still the member for Islington North as well.
He is
not the former member. He's still there.
But interesting, Starmer trying to compare, you know, Cameron and Braverman and sort of say they're both a security risk and you employed one of them and they've employed the other. Look, there's obviously sort of something that David Cameron needs to answer questions about. But making out that they're all kind of...
one in the same.
Is interesting.
But, I mean, in terms of political strategy, Rishi Sunak now really leaning into the... It has all been really good the last 13 years. The Tory party conference speech where the last 30 years has been a total disaster. Actually, the last 13 years of Conservative government, as started by his new Foreign Secretary when he was Prime Minister, all fine.
Well, and the other thing that was strange about the conference speech was we kind of figured that Sunak was going to run against former Tories. We just didn't figure he was going to run against David Cameron and George Osborne. We assumed he was going to run against Boris Johnson and Liz Truss. Now, Cameron's appointment means that it's now possible again. I think Danny Finkelstein wrote about this yesterday, that it, you know, it's entirely possible that this opens up space for him to start, you know, having a pop at Truss and Johnson in a more meaningful way. But it's certainly not consistent. And, you know, this is a guy who's been slightly perplexingly pitching himself as the change candidate. You know, bringing back, you know, the bloke who started it all is not the way to go about that either.
As Matt asks on the YouTube channel, has Sunak given up on being the change candidate? Well, don't worry, maybe he'll change again. Let's go back to the comments. This is question three from Keir Starmer.
The member for Islington North isn't even a Labour MP anymore.
Jeremy Corbyn.
A change party and strong leadership. Mr. Speaker.
Luke, with a lot of business today, very important business with some important votes, and I want to get through this speedily. Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, for 13 years our security has been undermined by this Tory government, and now the most ridiculous, pathetic spectacle of all. His Rwanda scheme, cooked up with his national security threat Home Secretary, has blown up. He was told over and over again that this would happen, that it wouldn't work, and it was just the latest Tory gimmick. But he bet everything on it, and now he's totally exposed. The central pillar of his government has crumbled beneath him.
Yeah.
Does he want to apologise to the country for wasting £140 million of taxpayer cash and wasting his entire time in office?
Mr. Speaker, obviously the person officer didn't hear what I said about our approach to Rwanda, and not least when it comes to stopping the boat. Rwanda is one part of our plan which has already delivered a reduction in the number of small boats this year by a third, Mr. Speaker. But he talks about apologising, he talks about the former member not being a Labour MP now. Yes, he wasn't a Labour MP when he declined 15 different times to say that Hamas was a terrorist organisation this week, which is shameful. But he was a Labour MP. Indeed, the Honourable Gentleman served with him. He told the country he would make a great Prime Minister. At that point, he described Hamas as friends. Does he want to apologise for that now?
It's a thin ice approach, this, isn't it? I mean, so Jeremy Corbyn, the point he was talking about there was Jeremy Corbyn went on Piers Morgan's show this week, and Piers Morgan asked him 15 times to call Hamas a terror organisation.
Well, I mean, he doesn't think they are.
Yeah.
You know, at the end of the day.
And
we kind of know that. And, you know, go back to the phrasing of what, you know, how Starmer phrased the previous question about, you know, was he so desperate to become Tory leader that he was prepared to install Suella Braverman? Well, you know, you can equally well say of Starmer that he was so desperate to become Labour leader that he pretended to the Corbynites he was on their side and then dumped all his pledges. And, you know, well, I think this is reasonably effective mudslinging from Sunak. It's not, you know, it might, we might be sort of weary of this meme, but...
But it works.
It does kind of, it does, you know, it's A, it's legitimate in one sense, and B, my understanding is it, you know, they do think it works to a degree. So, you know, it's sort of, it's robust politics. And it's interesting that Starmer's taken this approach because it was always going to lay him, you know, they would have known it would lay him open to this attack. And he looked pretty peeved on the front bench there when the cameras cut to him. He didn't look like he was terribly happy about it, and he can't have been terribly surprised.
Keir Starmer.
Yeah.
We should point out that sitting either side of Rishi Sunak is Oliver Dowden and his new Home who's obviously the Deputy Prime Minister, and his new Home Secretary, James Cleverly. And
I would say Cleverly's nod is a sort of sage, slow nod in the Braverman role, rather than that of a sort of one of the Churchill dogs in the back of a car going, oh, yes, as the head goes up and down.
It's the Braverman issue we had before. Right, let's go back to the House of Commons. If you want to see what they look like on the front bench, get online to the Times Radio YouTube channel, where lots of people are arguing about how who's being more desperate, basically, Rishi Sunak or Keir Starmer. Go back to the comments then. Question four from Keir Starmer.
Are we serious?
Oh, actually, no. It's intervention number three.
Because I'm going to tell it.
Lindsay Hall.
I won't challenge. Because I've got to say, our constituents are watching this. They're very, very concerned about the affairs of today. They're very concerned about the votes later. A lot of members wish to speak. Those who don't want that to happen, please go outside, go and have a conversation there. You want to bawl and shout, do it elsewhere. But it won't be happening in here today. Keir Starmer.
That's all aimed
at
Tory
MPs. Mr. Speaker, I'm so glad he agrees this is a changed Labour Party. And while he was wasting his time on this gimmick, the asylum backlog has swollen to 175,000 people. Taxpayers are paying £8 million a day on hotel bills, and 615 people arrived by small boat last Sunday alone. Plan A has failed. And after this session, whether he likes it or not, he'll have to go back to his office, back to the drawing board, and start from scratch. Yeah. Can he assure the British public that he will drop what his former Home Secretary calls his magical thinking and start treating small boat crossings with the seriousness that they deserve?
Mr. Speaker, he talks about a changed Labour Party. Perhaps we'll see that this evening. He can't even make his party do the right thing when it comes to standing by Israel in the vote later today. He talks about taking small boats crossing seriously. He's opposed every single measure that we have taken, Mr. Speaker. Again, let me update him on what we've done this year. The number of illegal Albanian arrivals, down by 90%. 20,000 people returned this year. The number of crossings, down by a third. He mentioned hotels, closing 50 of them. Money being saved for taxpayers. All, by the way, opposed by the party opposite. What is the Honourable Gentleman's plan? Ah, yes, there we have it. A cosy deal with the EU, which would see the UK accept 100,000 illegal migrants. He doesn't want to stop the boats. He wants to welcome more of them.
Don't totally know how Keir Starmer's managed to blunder into so many bear traps.
The
Labour Party.
It wasn't quite an open goal, but it was certainly an opportunity to rack up the score today. And it, you know, we're on to question. We've had four questions, and if it's better than two all for Starmer, I'd be surprised.
The gags on the reshuffle weren't very good, which is what we're looking forward to. Actually, framing the whole thing through David Cameron's legacy might have been better, but instead, you know, he's now being duffed up over Jeremy Corbyn, which, you know, like it or not, and some people getting in touch saying they don't care, but, you know, it clearly works. And then, bluntly, the Labour Party don't have a plan for dealing with the small boats either.
Well, I mean, they have put forward the idea that you need to clear the backlog and that, you know, you could do some kind of arrangement with the EU. But the second they said what that might look like, the Tories pointed out it was 100,000 more people, and then they said that wasn't their plan at all. And I think, you know, people who care about this will smell that really there isn't a lot there. And again, you know, Sunak is right to say everything they've done has been opposed. Now, you know, that doesn't mean what the government has been doing is necessarily sensible or effective. And in some regards, it's neither. But they have reduced the numbers. And Starmer at the moment doesn't have a particularly convincing story to tell on this. But the whole, yes, I mean, I'm with you, the whole structure of this has been slightly curious. You know, and you can open with the reshuffle stuff if you've got a series of genuine belly laugh gags,
or use
that as the way into everything else.
Or you could use Suella Braverman to drive a wedge between the Prime Minister and his MPs, which, you know, that could be done but effectively by leader of the opposition.
Well, once more, I'm left to conclude that, you know, you and I might be quite good at this.
Yeah. Imagine. let's go back to the House of Commons and see if it gets any better. This is Keir Starmer, question five.
Mr. Speaker, it's very straightforward. He promised that he would stop the boats this year.
Yeah.
This year. Today is the 15th of November. He's wasted all of his time on a gimmick, and now he's absolutely nowhere. Will he level with the British public and finally admit he's failed to deliver on his promise?
Mr. Speaker, this government has done more to tackle illegal migration than any in the past. And again, let's just review, Mr. Speaker. He's been on the wrong side of this issue his entire career. This is a man who described all immigration law as racist. He said it was a mistake to control immigration, and he has never once in this place voted for stricter asylum rules. It's clear, Mr. Speaker, while he might want to listen to the open border activists, I'm siding with the British people.
Oh, dear. I mean, of all the weeks you'd have thought you could have duffed up the Prime Minister, I mean, potentially this week might end up being both simultaneously his best and worst week as Prime Minister. Well, if your question is, will you level with the British public that you failed to deliver on his promise, what do you think he's going to say?
No, I know. It's a total non-question. A bit like the previous one, where he was effectively saying, you know, he's got to go back to the drawing board and start from scratch. Well, he'd already laid out his plan B even before the PMQ started. So there's not been a lot of sort of tap dancing and responding to...
Excuse me. Sorry, that was an enormous sneeze on my
so
part.
So shocked by Starmer's performance that we've...
I've developed an allergy to it.
...expectorate some air. This is... look, I make this point, you know, with crushing and boring regularity on this programme, but, you know, half of what matters about PMQs is a headline, and the other half is what do your troops leave the chamber with their dander up or their sulk on? And Tory MPs, I suspect, will be in the dander game after this. They'll be pretty happy with how Sunak has punched back on this. And I think the counterpunches, frankly, have been rather harder than the initial jabs.
And actually, at a time when Keir Starmer's got his own... Keir Starmer needs to gee up his own troops, given the tensions and divisions over supporting a ceasefire in Gaza. This doesn't feel like a thing which is geeing him up. Lots of you now getting in touch. Fair play to Sunak. Starmer's been rubbish. This should have been an easy win today. Can he really be an effective PM? Let us know what you think. Post your comments on the YouTube channel. Text me 87222. Start your message with the word Times. Let's see if it improves at all in the final exchange. This is question 6 from Keir Starmer.
I would have thought he was confident about his promise. He would have given an answer saying he stands by it and will deliver by the end of the year.
Yeah.
But the absence of that answer is absolutely amazing in the circumstances. He's had 3 reshuffles, a forgotten conference speech, an empty King speech.
Yeah.
He even found time to fanboy Elon Musk. But not one of them has made the slightest difference to the lives of working people. If we had a pound for every time we had a reset, the cost of living crisis would be over long ago. Now, he likes to think of himself as the man from Silicon Valley, the tech-savvy Californian, the country's first AIPM. And yet his big idea is to keep turning his government on and off and hope at the wall and hope that we'll see signs of life. Is he starting to feel that, as somebody once said, he was the future once?
I slightly missed the end of that, but I've got to say, I was glad to hear finally that the Honourable Gentleman did bring up the cost of living, because on that he is right. That is the number one challenge facing countries up and down the family. And today, he mentioned it, but what he failed to recognise, and he talked about delivering on promises, today was a day that we delivered on the most important pledge I make to halve inflation, Mr. Speaker. Delivering on a commitment, easing the burden for families up and down the country. What we would see from the party opposite is everything would jeopardise that progress, borrowing £28 billion a year, undermining our energy security, giving in to inflation-busting pay rises to his union backers. That's not a sensible plan, Mr. Speaker. It would push up mortgage rates, push up inflation, harm working families. All the while, we're going to continue delivering for the country.
Look, I think in that answer, Rishi Sunak has a far better general election pitch than he showed us at conference. Yeah. He talked about change and all that. I don't think that works. Danny Finkelstein's famous 3 ways you can win an election. One of them is, things are beginning to get better, don't let the other lot ruin it.
Yeah.
That's basically what you just heard from Sunak. So that's a sort of coherent position. Before that, we heard... there's been an interesting theme which we haven't talked about in some of Starmer's stuff, where he talks about you've wasted time and it's all gimmicks.
Yeah.
He's done that 2, if not 3 times during this. That could work for him. Some of the examples he gave, perfectly reasonable, you know, reshuffles, forgotten conference speech, fanboying with Elon Musk. The AI gag was destroyed by him stumbling over his words and... In the fashion that Margaret Thatcher used to do when she didn't really understand the joke that she was reading out, and that was pretty dire.
I thought that about a lot of it. Talking about fanboying Elon, I'm not sure fanboying is a verb that Keir Starmer would normally use.
And then, you know, switching it on and off at the wall. I mean, it's an okay joke, but it was poorly delivered, didn't work.
And it was a fortnight ago.
And then Sunak
God bless him, delivered us the highlight of the whole session for me when he talked about countries up and down the family. And we realised immediately what he said and just ploughed merrily on and then said families up and down the country again a bit later. But that was the highlight. Look, I mean, that was... I mean, I've had a message from a Tory MP who is not someone who is normally drowning in goodwill for the Prime Minister. Labour bench is much sadder than ours. Starmer was woeful. And that's someone who's not hugely supportive of Sunak normally. Amazingly, I think he won that.
I know, which you would not have thought coming into this. More than just getting through it, he's actually, you know, if there are wavering Tory MPs on the back benches, he might have just tilted them back towards his side today.
Well, those that are sort of open to him, I mean, he's probably got more enemies this week on his back benches than he had last week, but he may have more supporters as well. As I say, if what we heard at the end is what he's now going to pitch as his central argument, I think he's finally sort of arrived at the one thing that might stop the bleeding and potentially give them, some hope of getting close. Because I think most of what he's done between July and now has been sort of bizarre, to be honest.
On digital radio, on the web, and via the Times Radio app, Matt Chorley on Times Radio.
Very good afternoon to you. It's Matt Chorley on Times Radio, bringing you PMQs Unpacked with Lara Spirit, Times Red Box editor, and Tim Shipman, chief political commentator of the Sunday Times. So, Lara Spirit, you were watching the best of the rest. Overall, how was it?
It was very interesting today, actually.
Unusually so.
No, it really was. And I just listened to you both talking about how Sunak might have clinched it. I think he did struggle a lot with some of these questions.
Oh, that's good. Let's find out. We basically agreed that Keir Starmer flunked what should have been a great moment for him. So who are we going to first?
So we are, interestingly, going to Neil O'Brien first, who until a few days ago was, of course, a junior health minister. I was told earlier that he had been in attendance at a new Conservative meeting that had gone on just after the Rwanda ruling to plot next steps among those who are unhappy with it. And he asked a very forthright question here on the government's next steps.
The Speaker, last year through the Homes for Ukraine scheme, my family and I welcomed a refugee family to our home. And I'm proud that this country has always offered refuge to those who need it. But it's essential that we in this country decide who comes to this country. The Prime Minister has rightly said that he will do whatever it takes to stop the small boats and the evil trade around them. But isn't it apparent that after this morning's ruling, what it will take is a new law to override the Human Rights Act and to cut through the thicket of case law built up by judicial activism so that we can bring back control of our borders and stop the small boats.
Mr. Speaker, it's right that we go through the judgment carefully and properly. And as I said, the government has already been working in advance on a new treaty with Rwanda to address the concerns that have been raised, that were raised previously and that were raised by the Supreme Court, who also acknowledge that changes can be delivered to address those issues. But as I said, and I'll repeat, if it becomes clear that our domestic legal frameworks, or indeed international conventions, are still frustrating plans after that point, I am prepared to change our laws and revisit those international relationships, because we are absolutely committed to stopping the boats.
John Butler.
So this is a sign of the... And Neil O'Brien is not a sort of lunatic, head-banging, you know, right-winger as opponents might normally characterise him.
Exactly, no. He's involved, I think, still with the Onward think tank, which is, of course, centre-right think tank. It's not necessarily easy to put him in one box on this, for example, and it's not necessarily surprising, but I do think it speaks to concern that Rishi Sunak's team will have across the party are unhappy with the Rwanda ruling, that is not going to be contained to the kind of biggest Suella Braverman loyalists. I think this is a problem that will go beyond them.
I mean, Neil O'Brien is big pals with Will Tanner, who's the Deputy Chief of Staff in Number 10, who himself, as I understand it, thinks that they may need to withdraw from the convention. Liam Booth-Smith, the Chief of Staff, thinks it might be necessary. Nick Timothy, who's been advising them and is now a candidate, he thinks it's necessary. So O'Brien is kind of very much not one of the kind of outward headbangers on this. He's someone who has been working
very closely with people right at the top of government. I thought Sunak's answer was interesting there because he didn't in PMQs, but he did there talk about international conventions as well as the domestic law. So that made that slightly more explicit than it had been in the answers he gave earlier.
Very good. We're keeping an eye on James Cleverley's making a statement to the Commons, setting out the government a bit more detail of the Rwanda ruling. Not that many Tory MPs, as we said, from what you can see in the Commons. Let's carry on with the best of the rest for now, Lara. Where are we going next?
We're going to Greg Smith, the Conservative MP, looking ahead to next week's autumn statement and this vexed question of tax thresholds. Of course, this idea that many more people are being drawn into higher rates of tax, and a big question from those such as Sir Jake Berry, who have called this tax pledge to try and make sure there are no tax rises next week. Now, thresholds, I think, are a key thing to watch, and listen to Greg Smith for why.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. The inflation numbers this morning were very welcome, but the tax burden continues to bite. So will the Prime Minister agree in principle with me that the concept of higher rate tax was never meant to drag in police sergeants, Band-Aid nurses, teachers with additional responsibilities and others, and that a priority for his Treasury ministers should be to return fairness to the tax thresholds?
Yeah. Prime Minister.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I agree with the Honourable Gentlemen, and I'm pleased that the vast majority of people will continue not to pay the higher rate. I share his ambition to cut taxes for working people. Right now, inflation is falling, and we're sticking to our plan, which is delivering a halving of it this year, because that is the most effective tax cut that we could have delivered for the British people this year, rather than making it worse, as the party opposite would, borrowing money in the way that would be irresponsible and just drive up inflation and interest rates. But I want to reassure him that I absolutely share his ambition to cut taxes for working people, and as we stabilise the economy, that's something that both the Chancellor and I are keen to deliver.
JB.
I mean, this is the other thing. You know, it's not just Rwanda. The pressure from Tory MPs for next week, when we keep reading that there's headroom, 15 billion here, 13 billion there for Jeremy Hunt. And like it or not, they're going to want, if not next week, to go into an election saying they're going to do something about that.
Yeah, I think this so-called fiscal drag is a big thing. It's estimated to raise the Treasury, I think, $25 billion a year by 2027-28, which is when it's been extended to. But it's sort of one of these quiet, stealth tax rises that raises the Treasury a huge amount of money, but is actually vastly unpopular with Conservative MPs.
It's
and as you
very unpopular with MPs, but it makes very little difference to the public. Yes, it makes a difference in their pay packets, but you look at all the polling, people want headline tax cuts. They want to pay
because
it's one less P in the pound of their money. Yeah. But they'd, you know, this is one of the most bizarre things of the last 20 years.
This is the idea.
MPs obsess about
thresholds. There's a level when you start paying the 40p rate. And each year, if you get a pay rise in line with inflation, and obviously we've seen this week actually pay rises are going up a bit higher than inflation, but that goes up by five, everyone gets a pay rise in line with inflation, but a big load of that then tips you over the edge and then you end up being caught by
But you only pay the 40% on the extra bit.
You're still better off. You still have more money at the end of the month, yeah, even after you've paid your tax. And there's a reason why ministers like it, because it's stealth and it doesn't...
Exactly. It raises loads of money and it doesn't annoy the public nearly as much as it annoys Tory MPs. And if you come in with a, you know, whack, you know, the basic rate down to 19p, you'll get a disproportionate amount of political credit for that, even though fiddling about with thresholds is far more significant.
Tim is wrong. Thresholds do matter, says
Well, of course they matter, but it's, you know, they don't matter as much as Tory MPs think they do. You know, you look at all the polling, people follow the headline rates.
Yeah. One more?
This is a quick one. It's from Kevin Brennan and the Labour MP, and it is about the new Foreign Secretary.
He just said he had unprecedented experience. What would he say was David Cameron's finest foreign policy achievement?
Mr. Speaker, I think there's Mr. Speaker, in fact, the many to pick from. But what I would say is under his leadership, this country hosted what was widely considered to be one of the most successful G8 summits of recent time.
Blimey.
A G8 summit.
Well, they got a very nice table out of it, didn't they? This was all at Loch Earn in...
And
they got a lovely round wooden table, which is still upstairs in Downing Street to this day. Oh. And it was well organised, and they managed to achieve things at the time. Don't ask me what they were.
Very important.
But yeah, it's tricky to talk about his European policy, tricky to talk about his Libya policy, tricky to talk about his China policy. So at least we got a nice lump of oak.
Even his relationship with America, given he got Barack Obama to stick his neck out on Brexit, and that didn't work.
Well, yeah, and also managed to annoy Obama no end by failing to pass in the Commons plan to go and airstrike the Syrians over chemical weapons after Ed Miliband did the dirty on him. So, yeah, it's one of the areas where, you know, if he'd been talking about schools policy or welfare reform, he might have had a leg to stand on there. But
which is why
it's not notable that David Cameron was a successful foreign policy prime minister.
Right, that's another PMQs Unpacked, done and dusted. Thanks to Tim Shipman and Lara Spirit. If you haven't listened to it already, head over to How to Win an Election. It's a cracker this week. Peter Mandelson lifting the lid on how Gordon Brown brought him back into the cabinet over a yoghurt. That's Peter Mandelson, Daniel Finkelstein and Polly McKenzie on How to Win an Election, our brand new podcast. Head over and give it a listen now. But for me, Matt Cholley, it's goodbye.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt, so throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.